Welcome to a one-hour forum on WXPR Local Public Radio. Today in the White Pine Room, we have a panel consisting of people with different perspectives on mental health and mental issues. I'm your moderator, Ken Kroll. People from all walks of life experience mental health issues. Quite often, the medical community, law enforcement, and others are called in to work with a person having an episode. Yet for many, the stigma associated with mental illness and mental health often prevents those from needing help from finding services, and in many areas, it's very difficult to find help. Our panel tonight, before we get going, let's take a moment and introduce ourselves to each other, and let's start here on my right side.
Hi, I'm Mike Steffes. I'm the Rhinelander Police Chief.
Jim Scooball, NAMI Northern Lakes board member and consumer.
Anna McFiocchi, also on the board of NAMI Northern Lakes.
Andrea Stefanik, I'm manager of behavioral health services at Ministry.
And I'm Maggie Peterson. I'm the board chair of the Tri-County Human Service Center.
So some facts. 1 in 5 adults experience a mental health issue. 1 in 10 young people experience a period of major depression. And 1 in 25 Americans lived with a serious mental illness such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or other major depressions. So with that as kind of a background, Mick, give us some numbers, some ideas as to what some of the things that we're facing here in the North Woods.
Well, I guess what I would say is that the numbers that you just cited are true here. They're true everywhere. They're true all around the world. It's all a matter of trying to, what we're here for today and what NAMI Northern Lakes is committed to is serving people who are dealing with their own mental illness, serving their loved ones and family members who are trying to help those people, and public education. And so we're really grateful to WXPR for having this forum in order to forward that. But I just want to go over those statistics that you just cited, Ken, because it's depending on where you look, they'll say 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 people are dealing with a mental illness every year. That could be 25% of the population. That's 25% of everybody. And yet we have this idea that mental illness is somehow something that we should just hide. It's not that many people. That's a weird thing. And push it aside. 25% of the population dealing with anything is normal. That means it's a normal part of human experience. It's not unusual. It's 1 in 5 people every year. And the serious mental illnesses that you cited there, where you know, you kind of go in a descending order, where major depression and bipolar and schizophrenia, it's a much lower percentage of the population. It is still completely natural part of human existence. And that is just, to me, it's just so important for people to understand that this is nothing that that you can just brush away, or, you know, oftentimes people will say so-and-so should just get a job and everything will be fine. That's just not the way it is. So as far as the impact that these disorders have on people's lives, they're profound. You talk to Tammy over at the Frederick House in Rhinelander, serving even a larger area. NAMI Northern Lakes is trying to serve 3 counties. Human Service Center serves 3 counties. Frederick House, the homeless shelter, is based in Rhinelander, but serving it's like 3 full counties and parts of 2 others. It's 5 total. And the nationwide statistics, 26% of homeless people are dealing with 1 or more mental illnesses. The people who frequent the food pantry, a lot of people support the food pantries in their communities. A lot of those people are going to the food pantry because they don't have much financial resource, because they're dealing with a serious and persistent mental illness. It has a profound impact on people's lives. And one of the measurements that breaks my heart the most is the 90%+ of completed suicides are from people who are dealing with 1 or more mental health diagnoses. And so those are things that people need to try to wrap their minds around. Bipolar alone, a person with bipolar disorder is 30 times more likely to commit suicide than other people. So those are some of the things that I really want people to know. And in this era when, you know, we're hearing a lot about mass shootings and mental illness, and it's really unfortunate that that's kind of become a political thing, because there's no doubt that people with serious mental illnesses sometimes commit mass murder. But the murder rates in this country are very, very high. And the number of people involved when those murders who are dealing with their own mental illness is actually very, very low. People who are dealing with a serious mental illness are much more likely to hurt themselves than they are to hurt anybody else. And so, you know, what we're looking to do is to raise awareness.
I was just going to add, Mick, that the mentally ill are far more likely to be victims of abuse than be perpetrators.
Yeah, and you know, if you're looking for actual specific numbers, you can look this stuff up. But that is something I'm really glad you mentioned that, Andrew, because it's absolutely true that another thing I want to mention, because in the Northwoods there's a fairly strong alcohol culture, is that a lot of people, because the stigma against mental illness is so strong, the mentally ill person, him or herself, tries to hide. And so a lot of times people are feeling like, you know, there's something wrong with them. And so what they do is self-medicate. And in our area, the self-medication of choice is alcohol. And of course, that doesn't help. At all. Alcohol and illegal drugs just make things worse. So the more knowledge that can be out there, the less stigma that there is for both among mentally ill people and against mentally ill people, the better chance we have of people getting the kind of help that they actually need.
Well, let's explore stigma a little bit right now. And Maggie, maybe you can talk about that.
Well, one of the things I think that's a focal point for the kind of the mission of the Human Service Center is to make sure that they take care of all people in a very person-centered way. So when somebody experiences persistent and serious mental illness, they're looking to create natural supports for them and trying to have those around them be part of the solution and not part of further stigmatization or traumas that are going to exacerbate their mental illness.
So are you referring to then, you talk about stigma like within the family?
Sure. I think that sometimes
that's
people...
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, sometimes people are ashamed to even admit it to their own family and so don't seek additional help.
And the other thing that I know, a dear friend of mine has two adult children who are dealing with serious and persistent mental illnesses, and she has, I think, six kids altogether. And there's one of those siblings to this day. I mean, these are all, you know, middle-aged and late middle-aged people. To this day, there's the one brother who thinks that his two brothers just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get a job and stop with all this nonsense about mental illness.
Yeah, because they could do that.
Yeah,
because they have the skills and the ability, and they don't have the mental illness. So that lack of understanding and empathy, you know, is really disturbing and is hurtful. And actually, I think, makes the mental illness less likely to be cared for in an appropriate manner, because they might self-medicate or they might not seek treatment.
And that is the number one reason why people do not access mental health services, is because of the stigma. And so what happens is that people end up in the emergency rooms with medical problems that are related to their mental illness, like chest pain that's not related to cardiac issues or other medical problems. So stigma is very prevalent in all across the nation and in our community as well. Despite the efforts from the Human Service Center and the Mental Health Coalition that really try to educate the community and assist with improving access to services.
Go ahead, Jim.
Andrea, I'm going to jump in a second. I truly believe that this stigma is real, and it is something that people with mental illnesses face a lot, and it does stop a lot of times the proper medical help that they do need. And I think in today's world, with all the material that's available, all the education that is out there, I truly don't think there's a reason for that. But the stigma is real, from friends, from family, from complete strangers, and from coworkers, or wherever it may be. And it is out there. And a lot of times, it's also what I've noticed is that stigma is sometimes within the person who has the mental illness. And if that person with the mental illness can accept that they have the mental illness, they are freeing themselves of the stigma themselves.
That is so true.
Well, and we, Nami Northern Lakes had our first ever fundraising event Saturday night, and Dr. Harriet Walker, who works in Woodruff for Ministry of Behavioral Health, was our speaker. And I had suggested to her, I said, if you could tell your personal story, I said, that kind of thing is so important and so valuable. And so she did. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, thank you so much for doing that. Because in our society, as things are right now, that takes a tremendous amount of courage to talk about your family and or maybe your own issues or whatever. But I think what you were just alluding to, Jim, having the courage to do that is the only way to begin to alleviate some of the grip that stigma has on us. And you are a shining example of that, my friend, meaning Jim Skuball. I think a very, very, very courageous individual. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Well, Chief, we haven't heard from you yet tonight. And the law enforcement angle of this comes in as well, because often 911 is called and then you get called.
Sure.
Talk about what happens when, let's say there's a problem somewhere, a call comes in. What happens?
Well, I guess I'd like to begin by talking about the stigma that we've all been addressing here. And I think it's important, meetings like this, discussions like this, and getting this out in the open for everybody to talk about, because oftentimes you can meet with someone and they're willing to tell you about, you know, having the cold last week or that they had the flu or anything else, but yet the most complex organism possibly on the planet, our brain, we're afraid to admit can get ill. And we need to get past that. We need to get to a point where mental illness is not a stigma attached to it, and family members shouldn't feel down on somebody else in their family for it, nor should anybody be ashamed of it any more than somebody who gets the flu or something else tomorrow. We need to be able to talk about this openly and frankly.
I guess, how does a person know that they're sick? How does a family know?
I'll tell you, here's a typical story. I've heard the same story loosely repeated many times since I've been involved in NAMI. So you have a child, and oftentimes through that child's early life, you can already see there's something here. You don't know what it is, but there's something there. And then one of the statistics that is out there is that the onset of first diagnosis for mental illness is half of all people are diagnosed by 14, and three quarters are diagnosed by 24. So you've got this young person in your family, and you can tell there's something. But you know, they're going to school every day and they're doing okay, but it's just something nagging you. And maybe you even have them to counselors a few times in their young life, no diagnosis or anything. And then something happens. So it could be a suicide attempt. It could be that there is a cry for help in some way. And oftentimes it's a suicidal gesture, which is something that they do something that is, you know, perhaps dangerous, maybe something that's even potentially fatal, but they kind of make sure that they're not actually going to die. So it's really a cry for help kind of thing. So, but something happens in that young person's life that finally gets them to seek help. Unfortunately, we really just don't have enough mental health providers. in this country. And so oftentimes a family, I've heard this story so many times, they realize there's something seriously bad going on with their kid, and they try to get that child in to see a psychiatrist. And the next appointment is 3 months out or more. Well, if you're already on the edge of a mental health crisis, 3 months is not going to work. And so what ends up happening is there is some kind of crisis, and they end up in the emergency room. And that's, then if they're in an emergency room, they have to be seen by a psychiatrist. Okay, so they're in the emergency room. If there's been a suicide attempt or anything like that, they end up in the psychiatric ward for at least 72 hours, and they have to see a psychiatrist. It's kind of doing it the hard way, but if it's your child and they don't complete the suicide, at least you're now got your kid in care, you know.
And I've done stories that there's a physician shortage up in this area, so I imagine that Andrew, right. If you could talk about that.
Right. On the most recent statistics I saw was that our community should be able to support 11 psychiatrists. We have 4.
What is the highest number of psychiatrists we've ever had in the area? Do you know?
I think we were at 6 at one point. But it ebbed and flowed. So we have 4 right now, or 3 psychiatrists and 1 psychiatric nurse practitioner. And we have a great need for more. However, we've had positions out there for years, and it's very difficult to recruit a psychiatrist to this community. Most psychiatrists want to work in big cities. And
the shortage is nationwide, though, isn't
the
it?
The shortage is nationwide, yeah.
So there just aren't enough doctors who want to go into psychiatry.
It is a difficult field to go into.
But worse in northern Wisconsin.
Yes.
I guess that was my point, is that there's fewer people than the norm wanting to come to a place like Rhinelander, for instance, to
right,
work.
Right.
Would that be an accurate statement?
Yeah, an example of that is true at the Human Service Center as well. There's always been a psychiatric shortage and trouble recruiting candidates. So we have decided to use a telehealth system for people to be seen. So they're not in the same room. There's a screen with a psychiatrist, and a couple different psychiatrists work part-time via telehealth to serve the clients that we have.
Does it work? Does it seem like it works?
I have to admit to being skeptical when we first said we were going to try it, but we were already not recruiting psychiatrists to fill our void. And it is working pretty well. The screen is very clear, and the system is pretty seamless. You know, none of the freezing that you see with some kind of telecommunications things that are out there. And people really feel like they're sitting face-to-face with their practitioner. I think that having a person physically in the room would be better, but it is at least getting people seen and getting them some psychiatric care.
Well, Mick and I had talked before this about the concept of how people get care in this area. We have a couple of providers here, but there are other providers, correct, in the region?
Yes, there are several clinics. Part of what the Human Service Center does is run its own outpatient mental health clinic, but it also then contracts with area providers so that people that don't have a lot of funds can have some choice and access not only mental health services or AODA services right at the Human Service Center, but at one of the local clinics.
Okay.
The other thing that HSC does, the Human Service Center does, is provide the hotline. Yep. Right, and there was a change there this year, isn't there?
Actually, yeah, that's a great point. For the last several years, it had been one of the services that was outsourced and contracted with Options for that to provide that service. But we've brought it back in house. We did try to see if another mental health agency wanted to take over those emergency services, but they're being provided now by the Human Service Center, which has some benefits to it in that it's actually somebody who's part of the Human Service Center who is going out and doing the actual screening. And our relationship with law enforcement is good and strong, and it just takes one other, you know, there's not then three agencies trying to deal with that situation. It's down to two, law enforcement and the Human Service Center. So I do think that there are some pluses to the fact that we needed to take that back over.
Yes, that is one of the issues with mental health services in any community is the fragmentation of services. With our community in Oneida County has been very proactive in that we really work very closely. We as Ministry Health and the Human Service Center, law enforcement, Options, Koinonia, Social Services, we meet on a quarterly basis to talk about all the issues that go on in the community, any problems that might have happened in the emergency department, the barriers to getting the services that we need for our most vulnerable patients. And we've developed such a good relationship within our own community that we are able to now pick up the phone at any time and say, this is what's going on, can you help? And it really has made such a difference at breaking down those silos and being able to get coordinated services for our patients, which is so important for mental health, because usually people with a chronic and persistent mental illness are connected with many different agencies in the community. They might be involved with law enforcement, social services, hospital, outpatient services, schools. So that kind of a system that's highly collaborative is really important. And I think we've done a good job, and there's lots of work to do, but we're out at the forefront.
Yeah, but those conversations and the fact that everybody is collaborating on a regular basis and there's a system for that communication, I think, is part of what's helped make it stronger and better and more seamless. We all know that an out-of-home placement or a hospitalization is a traumatizing event for an individual. So anything that we can do to prevent that by working better together and putting natural supports in place, or as we call it at the Human Service Center, a diversion from those costly and traumatic placements is in everybody's best interest.
We've been working since 2007 with these collaborators meetings, bringing social services, human services, the hospital, corporation council, and pretty much everybody that we can to the table to make sure that we're having very effective and efficient meetings, so that when we have a consumer that we meet from the first introduction to law enforcement through to the point where they're either placed and long-term care can be as efficient and non-traumatizing to somebody as possible. And Mick and I have recently begun working real hard on a crisis intervention team for our area. But as we've researched it, many of the players that I see these larger communities trying to bring to the table and make these partnerships, I feel like we've already forged those. So a lot of the legwork for that has already been accomplished.
Yeah, it sounds like this the crisis team is in place, but it's not been formally given a name or anything like that.
Exactly, yes.
Well, the crisis team that Mike's referring to there is crisis intervention team training is a nationwide effort started in Memphis, right? Yes. Yeah, the Memphis model it's referred to now. And it was the NAMI chapter in Memphis that got together with the police chief in Memphis, and I don't know who initiated the meeting, but they talked about how, well, we got this situation, right? What is the first interface for somebody in our country if they're in a mental health crisis? And it's often a call to 911. So it's law enforcement. It's not psychiatrists. It's not even, any kind of mental health professional. It's a cop. And so, bad things can happen when you've got a police officer who is armed and who is trained and who is his effort is to serve and protect, but he's also going to protect himself. And he's now faced with a person who's behaving in a pretty bizarre way. And so what they started talking about is, what can we do about this? So in Memphis, they put together a curriculum, and it worked. They put together a curriculum for cops to be trained in how to recognize. Well, Mike should really speak to the details of it, but the whole idea is to help police officers recognize the difference between somebody who is just having a mental health crisis and someone who is really out to harm people, maybe high on drugs or alcohol or something else, and how to recognize the difference. We're asking a lot. We're asking a lot of our police today. And I have tremendous sympathy for the officers working with Mike and with Chief Elvins out of Tomahawk and Phil Schmidt, who's the law enforcement instructor at Nicolet, on this project for the last few months. My respect for these guys has just grown enormously. And I respected you before, Mike, you know, this, so we have that straight. But no, it is absolutely amazing. And so you look around the country and some of the things that are happening. The one story that you know me, Ken, I could tell a lot of stories. The one story I want to tell is about a black gentleman. I believe it was Atlanta. It was in Georgia, anyhow. And he was had bipolar. He went off his medications, and he came upon a police officer. As I understand it, it was in an open area, and he kept walking towards the police officer. And it was a young officer. He kept walking towards him. He wasn't listening to the orders to stop and whatever, and the police officer ended up killing this fellow. And the man was buck naked, had nothing in his hands, but he wouldn't stop, he wouldn't listen. But, you know, Mike and I know that young officer had not had CIT. He didn't know what to do.
No, it was CIT.
CIT is the crisis intervention team.
Okay.
Training. And so then the specifics of the training, yeah, that's, I'd like Mike to speak to that.
Yeah, feel free.
Well, Mick and I began working on this in May, I believe, of last year.
There's a story behind that too.
And when Mick first approached me and started talking about crisis intervention teams, it was something that I had already been in the process of researching and believing that it was something that we needed to bring to our area. When we look at crisis intervention teams, it teaches officers to go beyond just interacting with somebody who's in crisis. It teaches officers, a psychiatrist comes in and talks to officers about the different types of mental health issues that we might be running into on the street, and then teaches us how to work and facilitate with each of those people to make sure we bring them to a good end. And it also talks a lot about how to approach a situation. Police officers know that when we're called to a scene, we need to control the scene. And that's what's ingrained into us from the academy, which in the academy, it used to be you get maybe a couple of hours of mental health training. In our new curriculum at the Recruit Academy, there's now 720 hours of training that a police officer goes through, and a substantial amount is actually related to mental health. I believe almost a week's worth of training is just related now to mental health issues and how to work with that, which is profound. But we also now have all of the officers on the street. So that's great for the Recruit Academy, for the young officers coming out. But now we need to talk to the seasoned veteran officers who went through the training to say, if somebody is acting out, and that's when law enforcement comes in. We're not usually called by a family that tells us, hey, my son has X, Y, and Z, and they're in crisis right now. It's usually my son smashed something, and they're screaming, and we can hear them in the background. And so the officer arrives on scene and from outside the house can hear screaming inside of the house and doesn't know what's going on, a chaotic situation. And oftentimes those officers end up inside of that house to try to preserve peace and provide safety. And now they're too close. They've gotten engaged to the person. The person sees the officer and knows they might be going somewhere tonight. They might be going to jail. That's usually their main concern. And so they start to believe that they need to have no other alternative. They need to either go through the officer or flee from the officer. And so those are the situations where we want to learn now, and not only at the officer level, that's going to be our first stage is teaching the police officers, but we also want our dispatchers to know. So the moment that they take the crisis call, they can be relaying information to the officer to teach or tell the officer what type of crisis they might be responding to. So maybe we have the family come out to the officer instead of go in. We keep good safety and distancing, you know, from people, so we're not a threat to the individual who's in crisis. It's now going to believe that we're there just to take them away.
And at the same time, you don't really know until you assess the situation. So it's really a tough call for the officer, isn't it?
It really is. And we've been making some major strides recently. You know, several years ago when police officers started carrying tasers on the streets, people started reading newspaper articles about how tasers were killing people. And Taser International actually started doing major medical studies to determine what was actually causing people to die in police custody. And what they discovered was this phenomenon has been going on. First, it was when oleoresin capsicum or pepper spray was first introduced. People thought that that was causing fatalities in police custody. And then after the Department of Justice studied it, they realized nothing, it never killed anybody. Then we started seeing things that the TV show Cops started becoming very popular. And at the end of every fight and struggle, the person was hogtied. With their hands and feet behind them. So suddenly we said, oh, it must be positional asphyxia. They're laying on their diaphragm. They can't breathe. They must be dying from that. And boy, you know, we started doing all this difference, and we can't hogtie people anymore. We make sure that they're seated upright after a struggle, and people were still passing away in police custody. So Taser International determined and discovered that it was actually excited delirium. And so we started training our police officers on the cues of excited delirium, which is a chemical imbalance of the brain. And working in the front end of that with dispatchers who know what the possibilities of excited delirium are and what the signs and symptoms are, they relay that information to officers. So now before the officer ever even gets to the scene, they have medics en route and on standby. The officers make the scene safe. The medics immediately get in there and they give them whatever types of medication they feel appropriate to be able to get the person back out of that excited delirium so we can get them to the hospital safely, and recognize it's a medical emergency, not a criminal action.
Well, we're about halfway through our program. You're listening to a special program on mental health, mental illness, and other facets of it here on WXPR, Local Public Radio. Jim, we haven't heard from you. You mentioned you're on the board at NAMI and Consumer. Talk about your experiences or anything else you'd like to add.
Well, one thing when Mick was talking before about how do people as a family or a society recognize somebody that's mentally ill, you know, coming from a consumer's point of view, I look back in my earlier years, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what. I knew I was different. I knew something wasn't right. And as Andrea mentioned, you know, I went to the ER room several times, you know, thinking of a possible heart attack, this and that, and being checked out by the doctors for something physically. And it wasn't until one of my local doctors had made a comment, you know, that this may not be physical, that this may be something mental. And I was very upset, very mad at the doctor at the time. But I did happen to... When I called to get an appointment, and it was 3-4 months out, like we had talked earlier, and there happened to be a doctor that needed so many hours to become a psychologist, and they asked me if I was willing to take, you know, work with this young man, and I said yes. At that point, I'd be willing to work with anybody. You know, I was in a crisis myself, but the world around me didn't know that because I hid it very well. But we started our, you know, our road to recovery through therapy and through medication. But a lot of that is stigma. Stigma will keep you from telling people, especially if the first few people you do share with, you know, have a negative impact on you. And then that just buries you deeper. And you think that you're the only one in this world that has this problem. So.
You would, somebody's hear what you just said. What should they do? Who might think, you know, they're kind of in your position. What should they do?
I would check, you know, I'd go with your primary physician, talk to your primary physician, and listen to your primary physician, and hopefully your primary physician is educated well enough to recommend mental health, you know, care if that is what is needed. You are not alone. I wish back in grade school that they had posters up as they do or drink milk and things of that sort. So when I came down with some of these, you know, situations that I had, some of these crisis problems I had, I could recognize that I'm not alone. I'm not the only one in the world. And I kept it from everybody. You know, I kept it from grade school on through high school, through college, and even through a lot of my professional career. And I kept it hidden. But, you know, my goal is, as an advocate and being on the board, is to educate people that having a mental illness is not a crime. And 20-25% of the population, you can't hide. And we need to do something about that. And we should not be ashamed of that as if somebody else had cancer. You know, we should not be ashamed. And, you know, we need to move forward and stop the stigma.
Jim, you just mentioned cancer. I just would turn 69 years old last week. And when I was a kid, people didn't even say cancer out loud. We referred to it as a C word. I mean, even if close family members were diagnosed, it would be like kind of whispered about. It wasn't really talked about. And I feel like that's kind of where we're at even now today with mental illnesses. So if I have a dream for what happens in this country going forward, it's that NAMI or some other national organization becomes the American Cancer Society of Mental Illness. And like now, I'll go to the YMCA and people will talk about their cancer diagnosis in the locker room. It's very little. I mean, it's still fearful, but there's no stigma attached to it anymore. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, someday, maybe not when I'm going to the Y anymore, but someday people in the Y locker room will be saying, yeah, I had a really bad day last week, but I'm, you know, I saw my doctor on Friday and I'm doing a lot better today. I mean, you know, it's just an illness like any other, and we need to get over this whole concept of it being a bugaboo.
Right. What I found out too throughout my life is, as I share my story, a lot of people will step forward and share their story, because I'm not the only person out there with depression or anxiety or OCD. You know, there's millions of people throughout the world that have that. And one of the differences is, let's use depression, for example, is if you have a dog and a dog dies and you're sad for a few weeks, that's normal. That's not necessarily a mental illness. But if that sadness continues on and significantly interferes with your life, that's when it becomes a mental illness. And there are millions of people with mental illnesses out there, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. And I think the more we can educate people, the better it's going to be. But it is an uphill battle. I felt the stigma. I felt discrimination for many years. And it's there. It's real. But I think it starts with conversations like we're having now to erase some of that.
Go ahead.
I just want to comment and expand a little on something that you said, Jim, about if someone out there is struggling, has some kind of issue that they're dealing with, you'd hit it right on the head that the first place that you should be able to go is to your family physician. One of the things that healthcare reform has really pushed is that in physician clinics, primary care physicians have what are moving into what we call the medical home model, where we have RN nurse coordinators and behavioral health specialists who work as a team with the family physician to help people who need mental health services navigate through the system of care, which can be so difficult to navigate through when you're having a mental health situation that needs to have some kind of service for. So definitely your primary care physician is the right place to go and the first place you should go to get right. The help that you need.
And I definitely recommend anybody, if it comes down to it, with the mental illness, with the stigma that's involved with mental illness, suicide is a huge part of mental illnesses. And a lot of people with mental illnesses, you know, unfortunately, you know, turn to suicide as a result. And those are, you know, obviously very serious situations turn ugly, you know. But when somebody reaches out and asks you for help, I mean, that person is suffering. They need your help. And I know myself. I know people in my life that have attempted suicide. I know people that have committed suicide. that have been mentally ill. And I think a lot of it goes back to if society would have accepted them more for who they are, not what society wants them to be, I think that could have been prevented.
I think you could probably do an entire show on suicide alone.
There is, yeah, absolutely.
But it's connected. And the one thing, not to be the devil's advocate here, but I sit through a lot of political meetings with county boards and this type of thing, and the one word that always comes up is cost. And I want all of you to talk how money factors into how this all treatment is done and how that is done.
I want to start on that because used to be in our country and pretty much the whole Western world, we had what we called asylums for mentally ill people. At least most of them were probably mentally ill. We didn't know much. So a lot of people just got warehoused because they had some abnormal behavior, whatever, and they'd get put in these places. And a lot of times, these got left there. And so we began to recognize as a society that wasn't right. There was some just horrible conditions in some of those places. And so in the 60s, we began shutting them down. And the idea was, I think this was in the Kennedy administration, the idea was that we were going to fund community-based mental health services. And so then we wouldn't need these hospitals. Well, costs, it's a good word. And what politicians love to do is cut costs. And so what they did was they closed the hospitals, stopped paying that money out. And then the community mental health services thing did not get funded very well at all. It did. I mean, our Human Service Center based here in Rhinelander is an example of that, but not funded nearly enough to take care of everything. So then what happens? 26% of the homeless population is people dealing with mental illness because they don't have anywhere else to go. You've got a set of illnesses that are very, very isolating. And so what do? We allow stigma to persist. And so a lot of these people are literally isolated, alone. I don't even want to go into the stories that I could tell you about situations of people they just hardly go out. And so that is going to eventually precipitate a crisis. And then, you know, somebody calls 911 and then a police officer or sheriff's deputy goes out and gets involved and takes that person to a hospital. And if the St. Mary's psych unit is full, which it often is, they have to be transported to Wausau if they have any beds. If there's no beds available in Wausau, then maybe Green Bay or possibly Madison. Well, when you say, oh, transported, it's a neutral word. They're transported to, say, Madison. But that means that somebody has to pay for that. This is not a family member taking them down there for free. This is state government ordered. This is how it's handled. And so it's usually law enforcement that transports them. So Mike and Maggie, you guys can talk about how that works, at least in Oneida County, in terms of costs.
Well, for example, in 2015, there were over almost 1,100 emergency mental health assessments that were completed. And some of those individuals were, as Mick was describing, transported to hospitalizations. And what people do to try to prevent those are the highest costs, and as I said earlier, the most traumatizing for individuals too, which I think is a factor that we have to keep in mind as we're talking about costs aren't always money, but sometimes they are factors that impede a person's ability to be whole or to be better. We try to work with law enforcement to assess whether or not an individual can be diverted. And that might be to a crisis bed. It might be to a 72-hour placement that is the most expensive option. Or it might be to some more natural supports, a family member that can guarantee that they're going to keep eyes on an individual for the next 24 hours or until they can get an appointment with their either primary care provider or if they're already established with a psychiatrist or some outpatient therapy with their counselor. I think that one of the things that comes from the relationships that we were talking about earlier is a coordinated set of options that might keep costs down and be better for people in the long run. So that's win-win. The Human Service Center is working in those monthly or quarterly meetings, excuse me, to create some more creative piloted options for diversion. And I think that they're going to hope to take that 1,100 crisis assessments that are happening and make more of those diverted and less and fewer hospitalizations.
Maggie, you are correct that the best treatment for people who are in a crisis is to keep them out of the hospital at any cost and with family or with emergency outpatient services. However, there is a subset of people that absolutely require inpatient hospitalization, and those people are what we see at the hospital at St. Mary's right now. We've take patients from our Tri-County, from pretty much the whole northern Wisconsin area, as well as the UP. And the acuity that we are seeing is increasing. We're taking less and less from Oneida and Vilas and Forest, but we're getting people from other areas because the beds in the state of Wisconsin have diminished significantly. So we're one of the only service, inpatient services in from Wausau up until Ashland, and those beds have shrunk in half in Wausau as well as in Ashland. So
you're saying hospitals have just reduced,
right?
Or a lot of hospitals are just eliminated, right?
Right.
Psychiatric units.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the cost, as Maggie had said, isn't just the financial aspect of it. Because when somebody falls under Chapter 5115, a law enforcement officer, after the person's been screened and the screener indicates this person needs to be detained for their own well-being and safety, that person's either going to be taken up on a floor here at the hospital, or if, as oftentimes occurs, they aren't available, there isn't a bed available here, our number one place that we go to is Winnebago County. So it's about a 3-hour drive. And that poor individual is sitting in the back of a squad car on one of our plastic seats. And for safety of them and for our officers, they're handcuffed. And that person now is taken all the way down under that detention to Oshkosh. And that doesn't help that person to want to reach out once they're, you know, back out after 72 hours and has hopefully a long-term strategy and some appropriate medication. If they start feeling like they're going to come into crisis again, they're probably not going to reach out to law enforcement. If they went into the hospital voluntarily to seek help and they fell under that 5115, they're probably not going to want to do that either, which, as Jim was saying, alludes to the person now trying to self-medicate or that stigma. I don't want to be in the back of that squad car again. I can't go to that law enforcement agency, and that person tries to deal with it themselves.
We have just about 10 minutes left. What are plans for the future? Mick, you and I informally had talked about that, you know, there's places in other communities where they have places that they can go. What would you like to see happen here?
Well, what Ken's referring to is the other major initiative that NAMI has taken on, because, you know, why take on one major initiative at a time? You might as well do two. But so we're working on the CIT training with law enforcement, but we're also working on opening what we're referring to as the Northern Lakes Center, a drop-in center for people with mental illness, by people with mental illness. And there are the Mid-State Independent Living has been one of our partners from the beginning. Ministry of Behavioral Health and the Human Service Center have also been partners in these discussions going back for a couple of years now. And Mid-State Independent Living covers this area, this part of their territory, but they don't. They have three drop-in centers, but they don't have one up here. And so we were meeting Robin Dunahy from Mid-State Independent Living. Has been the representative at our meetings, and I kept trying to talk her into opening yet one more drop-in center so that NAMI Northern Lakes would not have to take it on. But she kept telling me her boss would not let her. But anyhow, so NAMI has taken it on. NAMI is we are a nonprofit organization in the area, accepting your tax-free contributions right now today to open the Northern Lakes Center. We're very optimistic that we are going to be able to get it open this year. We just had our first actual fundraising event Saturday night. It was very successful and very appreciative to everyone who's contributed to it so far. But it's something that is by and for people with mental illness. And you say, well, you know, okay, what do they do there? You know, it's not residential. It's not a crisis center. It is a place where people who are dealing with mental illness and living with the stigma can go, where every single person in that building, it's probably the only place they can go, where every single person in that building completely understands what they have been through, what their life is like dealing with a mental illness, and does not judge them for it. It's like the only place. It's a place of their own. So we're hoping to get that open yet this year to diffuse the isolation, to prevent the crises. And what partly because, you know, bless her heart, Robin Dunahy's been driving up here from Stevens Point for almost 2 years to meet about this. We have statistics from the Rock Point, which is the drop-in center they run in Stevens Point, which shows significant savings in crisis intervention. So less hospitalizations, which means less transport by law enforcement. It means less trauma for the mentally ill people. I mean, when Mike described that, somebody in handcuffs in the back of a squad car, not because they're a criminal. They didn't do anything. Well, if they're going to Winnebago, no, most likely they're not under arrest, right?
Correct. They're just being detained.
They're just being detained, you know, for their own protection. Yes. But I can't imagine being put in the back of a squad car and driven for 3 hours, what that impact it would have on me. And I'm not mentally ill, despite what, you know, some of my former coworkers might think. So this drop-in center, we really have hopes to get it open. I mean, I look at what this community, and when I say the community, I mean the entire Northwoods. We're trying to serve Vilas, Forest, and Oneida counties with our NAMI group. You've got Frederick House that a lot of people said, no way, that'll never happen. You've got successful food pantries all around our area, where, you know, people need food, can get food. I think once the community understands the value of this drop-in center, we will receive the support that we need for that. But the idea is to have it open. We don't know, you know, it'll depend a little bit on how much we can raise, but 24 to 30 hours a week. And then as if we can grow it, then we can be open more hours. It'll be for socialization, for people to receive services. Human Service Center has also already told us they are going to provide services at the drop-in center for people. And so we're really looking forward to that.
I saw some heads shaking. Maggie and Andrea, you both think that's a good idea?
Definitely.
Absolutely. I've been working with Mick and the planning committee, and there's a lot of passion and action going on right now with the planning group. So it's a really wonderful group that's putting their time and energy into this, that I think it will be a huge success.
I think that and we've been getting frequent reports as well at the board level at the Human Service Center. One of the things that I think this is a great example of is that natural support that I was talking about earlier. It's going to be relationships built with the peers that will understand, a place for somebody to go to prevent a crisis and to have them not end up in the back of a squad car when, you know, that's only going to make things worse. So I think it's invaluable.
Okay. We have about 3 minutes left, and I'd like to go around the room and kind of let each of you first introduce yourself and reintroduce yourself again, and then say what your final thoughts are.
I'm Maggie Peterson. I'm the board chair of the Tri-County Human Service Center. I guess what the message that I want everybody to hear on behalf of our agency is that we have many programs and many professionals that are there to support and to make sure that the right services are in place for people who are experiencing any type of mental illness.
Andrea?
Andrea Stefanik, Manager of Behavioral Health Services at Ministry St. Mary's. And I just want to say that if for anyone who's struggling out there, please don't hesitate to talk to your family physician. Reach out before things get to a point where it is a crisis, because there is help out there for you.
Mick Fiocchi, I'm currently the board chair of NAMI Northern Lakes, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, here in the Northwoods. And there are services available. The meetings that NAMI has and the social events that we have, a great way for people to break out of the isolation. So if you've ever, if you ever find yourself in a situation where you feel isolated because of a mental illness you're dealing with, you can call us, you can email us. Ken will have the webpage link and email link on the WXPR site, and just make contact with people. Don't be afraid.
And when do you have your meetings?
We meet on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 7 o'clock at the United Methodist Church here in Rhinelander.
Okay. Jim?
Jim Scooball, NAMI board member and consumer. The thing I like to say is, no matter what situation you are in, what crisis you are in, you're not alone. You may think that you're alone. You may think that, you know, I'm a really bad person. This is something really bad that's going through my mind. No one else has this. But the truth is, there's millions of people that are suffering just like you. And hang in there. And if it gets worse, please get professional help. Call the police department. Call 911. See your medical primary physician. Whatever you need to do. Your life is worth living.
Thank you, Jim. And Chief.
Chief Mike Steffes, Rhinelander Police Department, and everybody took all the good answers so far. I guess I'd like to just say we've had a conversation for the last hour, and the biggest thing we have to remember is these are human beings who deserve to feel valued and respected and are very productive in our community. I mean, 25%, as we've talked about, of the people, that's 1 in 4 in any business setting of the people, are experiencing some form of mental illness. And so there shouldn't be that stigma, and we should be offering them all the respect that we can to help them feel comfortable and understanding when they do have crisis moments or anything else.
Before we go, Maggie, you have one more point to bring up?
I do. The crisis line number that we've made reference to at several points gets you access to the emergency services program that the Human Service Center runs, and that number is 1-888-299-1188. Again, 1-888-299-1188.
And we'll have that on our website as well for when this program is put there. And I'd like to thank all of you for participating tonight, and I'll always thank all of you for listening. I'm Ken Kroll, and thank you for listening.